Oi, oi, it's your boy, Jack Slack. It's the Jack Slack Boycast for the boys. My boys, I'm your boy. And I'm coming at you having just finished Dune Messiah. Couldn't sleep this morning, so I got up and finished the book. Yeah, bit of a mess. But people promised me that Children of Dune is really good, so now I've got to... I had to get through Dune Messiah to get into that. But Dune Messiah is like half the length of both Dune and... Children of Dune. So yeah, review coming. We're going to be talking about some fights today. Not an awful lot of news stories about that are particularly important, so I'm not gonna, you know, you can tell because like major websites like MMA Fighting are reaching with, oh, professional MMA fighter kills doctor over vaccine argument. And yeah, that is very on brand for MMA, but it's a dude with like two fights in bumfuck West Virginia or whatever. And the card this weekend, the more I look at it, the more I'm like, oh, potench. That's short for potential, for those of you who aren't English or Australian and can't make up a quick shortened version of a word on the fly. There's also a Rising card, but the Rising card is bizarre. I mean, their cards have been shite for ages, really. And people have been like, it's because they can't get foreign fighters into the country. And then they got like Bobby Olagon making his return for this one, who's 2-2 and famously got smashed by Bob Sapp like 15 years ago. They got a load of other weird stuff. Like their card, I don't know if this is the actual bout order, but the bout order on Tapology, they got Rina Kubota versus Miyu Yamamoto in the main event. Because, you know, women's atomweight is basically all they've got going on at the moment. And then they've got, like, on the same main card, Bobby Olagon, 2-2, versus Katsuya Kitamura, 0-0-0. Daryl Lukoku, 9-5-1, versus Noah Bay, 0-1-0. I have no idea what they're doing. But then I don't think they do either. But this UFC card, you know, the main event is very much phone it in. I mean, I imagine there's still people who are well into Miesha Tate. If so, why? If women's bantamweight, it's bad. But Caitlin Vieira, yeah, I suppose was a sort of like upcoming prospect we were all excited about until she lost to, wasn't Chikagian. Who's the other one? Was it Kunitskaya she lost to? Hold on. Yeah, Yana Kunitskaya she lost to in a decision. And since then, she'd been booked to fight Sarah McMahon. No idea why. McMahon hasn't really done anything lately. And then Miesha Tate just now. But that was cancelled the first time, and they moved it back a month because Tate got COVID-19. Miesha Tate hasn't been... like, after years of not really getting any attention, aside from being VP of one, she's, like, started a crusade. Well, basically, like, every day, she tweets something new about women's MMA and how it's being done wrong. Like, oh, Aspen Ladd's coaches her boyfriend, blah, blah, blah. I mean, she's doing it for attention, but could not care less about this fight, to be honest, fellas. And I'm not going to preview it because I do not care. The division's dead. The division's so dead that they're bringing back Miesha Tate. There's the realness test out of the way. If you can deal with that and move on, you're real. So let's keep going. Michael Chiesa versus Sean Brady is your co-main. Really like this. Fun co-main. Both guys who... their strengths match up against each other, so they're going to butt heads. But they're weak. Well, I mean, Sean Brady is okay on the feet. And Michael Chiesa is passable on the feet. He's better than a lot of people expect him to be on the feet. I think he's... because he's gone so far down like the Damien Maia path of... I know what I am. I'm going to dive at your leg and just wrestle you down or try to for 15 minutes. Because he's gone so far down that path, I think people forget that his hands are all right. You know, he's very long. He's a southpaw. He's awkward. He, before the Vicente Luque fight, I was saying, hey, watch out, because he did hit Jorge Masvidal very well. I think he might have dropped Masvidal, didn't he? But Masvidal has a lot of trouble with rangy... southpaws, especially. Doesn't like longer people because he likes to rely on his jab so much. Doesn't like southpaws because he likes to rely on his jab so much. I suppose that's something interesting about the Edwards match, which I just then realized is not happening anymore, so it's not actually interesting at all. But Chiesa's last one against Vicente Luque, he came out and he bounced around the ring, and it was basically like the 1980s Olympic boxing team, the US boxing team over again. They came up with this idea of lateral movement, straight hitting. So you would abandon your stance and side circle around the ring with your feet level almost. And then you would drop into your stance to throw one or two good punches, a good 1-2, a good 2-1. And they had great success with that against the Soviet team who were working on their own stuff. We talked about this before, like Soviets made more angles with weird punches or with their punches themselves. Americans were working on making angles by circling the ring. Very general terms. Obviously, a lot of guys who didn't just do that. But an interesting trend over the 10 or so years that it mattered. 10, 15? Because there were a couple that, like, they both, well, there were two Olympics back to back that one or the other boycotted. So there was no real competition there. But yeah, during that whole USSR versus US boxing saga, which was a very good time for boxing, but or amateur boxing. But yeah, Chiesa circled the ring, popped off with his hands, and he actually stunned Vicente Luque, who has not only a cast iron chin, but very good at slipping punches. I mean, it just goes to show the value of getting someone following you, because no matter how good they are, at some point they will get into the pattern of stepping and then continue the pattern before they can react. If you have someone chasing you around the ring and then you stop and pop, there's a good chance that their body's just going to be moving through the action already. And it's very wearing on your reactions to have to deal with that too, to follow someone but not closely enough that they can hit you immediately. And then you feel like you're losing something because you're not really putting pressure on them effectively. But Luque rallied and Chiesa got on his back, and then he managed to turn into his half guard and darce him from there, because that's Vicente Luque's killer move, his specialty. Before that Luque fight, we talked about how Chiesa has had a little bit of a favourable run. It seems like the UFC like him because they gave him ancient Carlos Condit, ancient Diego Sanchez, underweight and always bad against bigger wrestlers, Rafael Dos Anjos, and then a legit test in Neil Magny, who he beat. But three in a row there that were very much gimmies. Not sure why they love him so much, but he does do a lot of work in the booth for them. Or on the desk, rather. But with Sean Brady, it's been a hot minute. How long has it been? I think Jake Matthews was his last one, wasn't it? Yeah, Jake Matthews. Oh, but that was only in March. Man, that feels much longer ago. And before that, Christian Aguilera in late 2020. Nardiev, early 2020. So he's been busy through the pandemic, which is nice. But very hotly touted. Everyone was talking to me about this guy, saying like, oh, Sean Brady, he's the next big deal. He can grapple and strike, Jack. I'd say his striking's probably more dangerous than Chiesa's, by merit of having a good counter left hook and looking for it constantly, which you will see like hurt people. The shot that hurt Jake Matthews in the third round, I think it was a very short left hook. It didn't really look like it had much on it. It didn't make a big smack or anything. The only reason you knew that it was a big one was because Jake Matthews suddenly dropped to a knee. Good counter left hook is, yeah, money. The only downside is that he can get cracked with right hands over the top. He looks for it so often and so wholeheartedly that Junior Dos Santos Mark Hunt thing works well on him. If you step in deep and lean so that you're taking some of the stank off the left hook and throw the right over the top, big casting overhand, you can crack him with that. Aguilera was able to. And he went even like jab for jab with a lot of these guys too. But the counter left hook is good. On the ground, very, very powerful guy. I think it's quite interesting because his takedowns, a lot of them have come off kicks. He will trade like stumpy single low kicks with people in that sort of not really a kickboxer guy. The old school come out in sprawl shorts, list your style as Muay Thai, and throw big overhands and the odd low kick. But he does it and then the opponent low kicks back and then he takes him down. Just sort of runs through people on his takedowns, good on the double leg, often with the head on the other side, the Piotr Jan style double leg, which we like. And his top game is all about the guillotine, which is quite rare. You don't see an awful lot of guys looking for the guillotine from the top, because a lot of the time you go to your back to finish it. Not always. You can go to mount to finish it. And the notable similar fighter, I would say, is probably Joseph Benavidez. He used to get top position. I mean, we did a Filthy Catcher's Guide on this a while back. But he used to get top position, top half guard, get the underhook on the side where his leg was trapped, which is what you want to start knee cutting through or grabbing the head and doing the no hands pass. Underhook on the far side is the most important. But he'll use the underhook and that stops the opponent turning into you. You know, the whole way pinning people works is you stop their elbows from coming up, or you stop one elbow from coming up and the other one from going down. If they can't get over their elbows, they can't really roll over. So the underhook flares the elbow out so they can't turn away from you very effectively. And you're inside their shoulder so they can't turn into you very effectively. And that's true from a lot of positions. But it means that he can then use his other arm to reach over their head, you know, armpit over their head, and start trying to get his hand under their chin and searching for the chin strap guillotine. Because they're going to have a very hard time bucking up into him, rolling him over, if he's pressing them down with his shoulder inside of theirs on the underhook. And you can finish the guillotine with one arm, or you can bring that underhooking arm back inside your chest, between your chest and the opponent's, and grab your choking hand to assist it, which is another great advantage of the underhook, because if you didn't have the underhook, the guy could move his own hands inside his chest and or between your chest and start fighting your hands before you get the grip in place. By having the underhook and keeping close to him, you can pull your hand up through between your chests and grab a hold before he can really deal with it. Really strong move. He was looking for it constantly against Jake Matthews. Wasn't able to get it in the end, but like the whole of round two, he spends on top and of half guard. And every time Jake Matthews starts coming up on an elbow on the underhook, Sean Brady, the guy, just starts threatening the guillotine again with one hand wrapping over the head. And Jake Matthews goes back to his back to try and get to relieve the pressure. But I mean, he stepped over and mounted Christian Aguilera to get the finish with the guillotine in their fight. Mounted guillotines, mad powerful. Hard to get guillotines in the mount. People will occasionally try it on you, but it's very hard to like force someone's head off the floor and then get your whole armpit in it. Marcelo Garcia did a ton of guillotining from the top. Watch his match against Jake Shields back in the day when Jake Shields was Strikeforce champion, I think, or maybe just Shooto champion. But Marcelo does a backstep in Shields' guard and then wraps his head. And it's a clever thing that Marcelo does. Go watch the Filthy Casuals Guide to Marcelo Garcia, which is still up and will always be up, hopefully. But if he's in like a De La Hiva guard, he will backstep over it and start attacking the head, because if his opponent keeps the leg, like keeps their hand on the leg, they're not defending the choke. So if their hand comes off the leg to defend the choke, he just hops back into the guard again and he's free to move. He doesn't have them holding onto his leg anymore. Very clever man. And you don't see anyone doing that. Like you see the same principles in an awful lot of passes in high-level jiu-jitsu, but still no one backstepping onto guillotines anymore. But anywho, yes, this matchup. I feel like I always underrate Chiesa's wrestling because it is very strong. Like he's kind of like Kevin Lee, and he tried to Kevin Lee. You know, he's very good at, very early on, taking dudes down and getting on their back. But he's also a little bit more long-lasting than Kevin Lee in a lot of his fights in terms of, like, sticking to the grappling and being able to do it constantly. Diego Sanchez was on the way out and very much in his old age. Dotage? Is that dotage? But Chiesa was all over him for the whole duration of the fight. Same with Rafael Dos Anjos. He can drive a high pace while trying to ragdoll people. And he doesn't always have the prettiest takedowns. He doesn't have the most, blast through double leg or anything like that. But he will just keep attempting takedowns and grind you down. Quite a decent cage wrestler, too. So, yeah, interesting to see how that works, especially because Sean Brady is a strong wrestler in his own right. Haven't seen a lot of people try and take him down, really, because he's got such a great reputation on the ground. But we all know Michael Chiesa is going to come out and try and take him down, because Michael Chiesa is not going to box with him for three rounds, almost definitely. I mean, it'd be weird if he does, and I'll applaud him, but yeah, I think this one's quite a, from Chiesa's side, you've got quite an honest matchup. He's probably going to try and get him down. And from Sean Brady's side, you've got like, does he try and out-wrestle and out-grapple Chiesa, which would be incredibly impressive, or does he use his probably pretty significant edge on the feet in terms of like, he's got a counterpunch and he's got power, which is something that Chiesa really doesn't have a lot of. And by power, I mean, like, not just being able to knock down someone from time to time. I mean, like, throughout the fight, he can throw regular shots with good power over and over again. So yeah, I guess this is our sort of how serious should we be about Sean Brady fight. Next on the card is my boy, Hanayaya versus Kyung Ho Kang. Kyung Ho Kang's had the weirdest fucking career in the UFC. He's been with them since 2013. Came in March of 2013 against Alex Caceres. But he's only had like six or seven fights in that time. From 2014, where he fought Michinori Tanaka, to 2018, when he fought Guido Canetti, he didn't fight. And I imagine that's probably something to do with him being a South Korean of about military age at that time. Yeah, now he's 34. Fucking hell. So yeah, he just lost a big chunk of his career. But he's a fun enough fighter. I mean, he's got a win over Ricardo Ramos. Oh, sorry, no, lost a split decision to Ricardo Ramos. Wins over Taruto Ishihara. Actually, that's basically the only notable name. But a couple of interesting finishes. Good grappler. Scrappy striker, I would say. And very tall and long for the bantamweight class. But the fight is mainly interesting for Hanayaya. We came to see Hanayaya grapple, not Kyung Ho Kang do anything else. Yaya, so long he's been around now. I mean, he made his debut against Kid Yamamoto. How mad. Oh, no, he didn't. When did he fight Kid Yamamoto? So long now. I mean, he fought Kid Yamamoto in 2007. Fucking hell. And he'd already had like 12 fights by then. 2002, he starts fighting in MMA. And, you know, he was at 2003 ADCC. For about 6 or 8 years, ADCC, the finals of his division, was him and Leo Vieira, basically. It's really weird watching Hanayaya's grappling career because even as a grappler, a pure grappler, he's mainly getting his ass kicked until he'll pop his head out of like some back take the opponent's attempting, and then he'll get on top. And it's really odd. It's like a survival style. But it also means he loses on points a lot of the time. But his last one against Ray Rodriguez, I mean, Ray Rodriguez was not a superstar coming in, but Yaya just cut through him like a hot knife through butter. You know, the Yaya single leg, the working from half guard, passing from half guard. As we're always saying, like half guard top, that's where passes happen from. Passed his way to an arm triangle choke in the second round, got the finish. Is approaching some kind of record for submissions in MMA, but I can't remember what it is. And really, like, yeah, that was probably his best showing since Luke Saunders, who he heel hooked back in 2018. Fought Ricky Simone, had a hell of a lot of trouble with Ricky Simone, because obviously how are you going to take down Ricky Simone if you don't have really good wrestling? Then he fought Enrique Barzola, who actually is a decent wrestler in his own right, and that was a draw, but I felt like Yaya got off lightly with that, because he did well in the first round and then he gassed. And then the last two rounds, I really enjoyed. I actually wrote an article at the Fight Primer about, because it was so interesting and fun. He was doing lots of clever things to pull Barzola on top of him into like deep half guard, but then popping his head out the back and locking his arms around Barzola's waist so that his head was behind Barzola's butt, so Barzola couldn't really hit him very well. He was finding all these clever, and his escapes from bottom side control, he'd turn up into turtle and like headlock him. He was finding all these clever ways to like stop himself getting beaten up while also being really tired. But it was a fight where he looked bad. So it was nice that he got a good win. This Kang bout was scheduled for a couple of months ago, but Yaya got COVID. Can't imagine that'll help his conditioning, which was already a bit sus. But yeah, I hope he does well here. I love a bit of Hanayaya, as you well know. Continuing down the card, we've got Joanne Calderwood versus Tyler Santos. I don't know why Joanne Calderwood is Joanne Wood on Tapology, but she is. Meanwhile, Tyler Santos just fought the other day, beat Roxanne Modafferi in a decision, and looked really good in it. I didn't catch her one against Gillian Robertson, or maybe I did and I just forgot it. But she's on a little streak of three: Molly McCann, Gillian Robertson, Roxanne Modafferi. Had about 100 cancelled fights in between. And now she gets Joanne Calderwood, who's always sort of like top five of the women's flyweight division. Calderwood coming off a loss to Lauren Murphy, last title challenger, split decision. Beat Jessica Rye before that, lost to Jennifer Meyer before that by armbar. You know, just like everyone who beats her goes on to a title shot almost immediately. She's always, it seems like she's almost always in title eliminators and then loses them. Yeah, this will be fun. I mean, Tyler Santos is thing is supposedly her striking. But I was impressed with her wrestling in the Modafferi match. Calderwood, lovely clinch striking. And even against them in that losing effort against Laura Murphy, I really did enjoy watching her strike from the clinch. You know, it's working so well for Andrea Lee at the moment. Not an awful lot of good clinch strikers in the sport generally. So if you can do it in women's MMA, you're even better off. Don't have an awful lot to say about that fight. It'd be nice if JoJo finally got her title shot, but, you know, you have to put the wins together to do that, and she keeps sort of, like, choking at the last hurdle. Falling at the last hurdle? Yeah, that's the one. Then we got the fight that I'm actually here for, and probably the last fight where I know both the participants on this card. Yes. But, yeah, the fight that I'm here for is Adrian Yanez versus Davy Grant. Absolute banger of a matchup. Both coming off hard fights. Davy Grant lost a decision to Marlon Vera, and Adrian Yanez wiped the blood out of his eyes and walked down Randy Costa after getting an ass kicking for the first round. I actually sat down and watched both those fights, the Costa-Yanez one and the Grant-Vera one. And I actually watched the first Grant-Vera one as well, by accident at first. And then I was like, actually, no, I will watch this. Because I was thinking, damn, did Marlon grow that full beard between this Davy Grant fight and his most recent one? No, it was young Vera with no beard. But Davy Grant has also had a strange career. No mandatory military service. But he fought Marlon Vera back in like 2017, 16, I can't even remember what it was. But basically, between the Vera fight, the two Vera fights, he fought four times, Vera fought 13 times. Just crazy numbers. Which obviously, like, Davy Grant's getting quite old now. He's 35, coming on 36. And to put together any kind of run, it's tricky because, like, he's only fighting every now and then. So he got two good knockouts back to back, Martin Day and Jonathan Martinez. Jonathan Martinez is actually a really good fighter. I rate him quite highly. He had a good fight the other night that I completely forgot to talk about on my post-fight podcast. And but I think I live-tweeted it, and I summed it up by saying, like, Jonathan Martinez is a very talented fighter. It kind of like pre-breakthrough Masvidal or someone like that, where he's got a ton of technical skill, you can see, but he's not picking up the important stoppages. When he does win, it's like, oh, technically impressive decision. Well done. So I was impressed when Grant knocked him out. But I think that was the fight where he tried about 100 stance switch right uppercuts into left hook, left overhands. But then he finally caught him in round two. But yeah, the Vera loss derailed him somewhat because he had three wins, two knockouts in a row going into 2021. And now he's sort of dropped a step, and he's definitely getting to the age where it's very unlikely he's going to, even if he puts it all together, he's going to make a title run or anything like that. Whereas Adrian Yanez is a guy who's very hot coming up. Everyone expects him to do great things, and he had been looking awesome. Contender Series, first round knockout. First two UFC fights, impressive knockouts. Third UFC fight and most recent fight was against Randy Costa. Took an ass kicking. Did still get the knockout, though. And that was, if anything, that was probably more impressive for someone like me, who's always like, I don't need to see the same things over and over again. I need to see you tested by new things. And there have obviously been parallels drawn between Yanez and Jorge Masvidal, not just in sort of appearance with the little beards and everything. He does look a bit like a young Masvidal. But the style is alarmingly similar. It's quite an upright style. Higher hands and then reliance on the jab and quite light on the lead leg as well, which is very Masvidal-esque. That was the strange thing about Masvidal. He always had a style that looked anti-good takedown defense, and then he had good takedown defense. But to stand in almost like a light lead leg Muay Thai sort of stance and then box out of it, very peculiar. And Yanez has great hands, great counters, great leads, great jab. And really in that Randy Costa fight, you got to see him having to call on other parts of his game to get through it. Because what Randy Costa did was he came out and he threw lots of jabs, lots of 1-2s, and tons of high kicks, which is why he gassed so quickly. But by throwing up these high kicks and question mark kicks constantly, he made it very hard for Yanez to move his head and get out of the way of things. And he also kept the pressure up, so Yanez didn't get really any time in between. So there were moments where Yanez would slip a punch or a kick, and then he'd go to drop his hands and mean mug or something like that, and he'd immediately have to get back in position. And Yanez got beat up by that. Like, he couldn't move his head side to side, so the jab kept coming in. And it was a good jab, too. Like, it probably would have caught him without the high kicks as well. But with the high kicks, he'd been threatened, don't slip your head to either side, because at the end of every engagement, there's a high kick coming up on one side or the other. It's like when anyone threw a body kick at Ross Pearson because he used to duck down so low. The body kick would become a head kick and he'd duck into it. So he stopped doing it and then he'd become much more hittable with just straight punches on the feet. But Yanez got back into that fight by using a number of different techniques. He started throwing the calf kick. He started throwing the oblique kick to jam Costa from coming forwards. He started landing his own jab by jabbing with Costa. Landing good counter right hands across the top of the jab. That really made Costa take a step back. So he managed to put him on the back foot quite successfully. And then he got in, dug to the body, and came up with the uppercut on the inside. Really nice knockdown and knockout, actually. Yeah, it was just really good to see him. And one of the things I really liked about him was by establishing the calf kick and the oblique kick, he was able to use a rear leg feint to start working his way towards Costa without really opening up. By which I mean, like, most fighters, or certainly Yanez at least, when they have their feet in, like, forward and 45. So their front foot, their lead foot is pointing forwards at the opponent, and their rear foot is pointing out at about 45 degrees. And then if you come up onto the ball of that back foot and you turn your back knee towards your front knee, you can make a hip feint and look like you're about to kick with either the oblique kick or the calf kick or any other kick you've been throwing with your rear leg. And you can do that and pull your back leg up a little bit underneath you, as we're always talking about sneaking up the back leg, and then you can thrust into jabs and things like that. So he was able to use that really well to take away some space to put Costa on the cage and eventually get that stoppage. So he has a lot of tools, and I think that's something that Davy Grant also matches up well with, uses both stances. Yanez doesn't really switch hit, whereas Davy Grant uses both stances pretty much constantly, loves the switching southpaw lead uppercut, so he goes from orthodox into southpaw with the right uppercut. Good with his low kicks. Against Vera, the first round, he was doing lovely, like, skip up lead, low kick, put that leg down behind, and then skip up lead, leg, low kick off the other stance. It was really nice. And just annoying Vera with his jab and stuff. His jab was decent. He doesn't really throw, like, a 1-2 an awful lot, or didn't in that fight. And then he'd come in wing-wide body shots. And I remember at the time, you know, revisiting these two fights, I've seen different things that I remember saying at the time, but that's watching fights. That's the difference a few months makes to your, like, outlook on things as well. But I remember at the time saying, like, I would have liked to see him using more body hitting. I think I said, like, body jab as well. But he landed some nice wide body shots in the first round. And then in the second round, he went in to do them. And Cheeto covered up, put his head against Grant's as Grant stepped in with his hands down, and then grabbed the collar tie with his lead hand and hit him with four elbows on the way out. And that was where it all started going downhill for Davy Grant. And that reminded me of the Yudong fight, but that's just what I love about Marlon Vera, you know, just looking for those long clinches, long grips to keep a hold of the guy and hit him. Because if you're having trouble with the guy getting in and out, this is, you know, Dustin Poirier versus Joe Duffy's the other one I always use. If you're having trouble with a guy who's being very slick, you know, don't let him hit you, but when he hits you, grab his fucking hit and then follow him back with three or four punches. But yeah, that was a good competitive fight. Vera came on stronger in the later rounds. Davy Grant was having it completely his way for the first round, basically. But I think Davy Grant could do with competing, like, as often as Vera did, you know, just against lower level competition, like guys like Andre Yule. Just build up some confidence, build up a highlight reel, because he'll be able to stop those guys. But he can't really, like, he's just not able to stay healthy and active. But then he's developed this weird style by being in the gym the entire time, nursing injuries between fights. So, you know, it's a weird way that he's turned out. But I enjoy it, and I'll happily watch him against anyone. I think it's interesting to think about what he can do here, because Yanez is obviously the hot property. He's probably going to be a bit quicker than Grant. And Grant obviously can't come out and mimic the Costa game plan, because the Costa game plan relied on you being able to throw up hundreds of high kicks around. And even that gassed out Costa, who was used to trying to do that. So, yeah, probably not going to get by very well with that. I think probably lots of lead leg kicking, making him pick up the lead leg and faking your way in and coming in with punches afterwards. probably a bit dangerous to be dropping the hands for those wide body shots. I think he should change his level with those. That was something I noticed against Vera. Well, I noticed because he got beat up off it, but doing those body shots with wide hands like Aldo, you know, big loopy body shots, but not changing level, just doing it so that you're punching down rather than coming down and punching level with your shoulders. And it makes you very, very hittable because there's so much space between your hands and head. Whereas if you come down low, you know, you've got a little bit further to duck if they start trying to punch back at you. If they're throwing hooks at you and you're like chest level, it's very awkward for them. I would love to see Davy Grant apply like a good body jab or a good body straight. But I think low kicks and overhands would be probably enough for him here if he can actually get Yanez biting on the low kicks and then stepping through on overhands from the opposite stance and so on. But Yanez, establish the jab because Davy Grant's going to have trouble with that. Look for the low kicks of his own. You know, these guys could just come out and kick the shit out of each other's lead legs. David Grant, decent grappler, actually. We haven't seen Yanez tested a lot in that regard. So, and David Grant has been talking about old man strength, how he's 35 and he feels stronger than ever. So, yeah, fuck it. Take him to the clinch, make it ugly. The clinch was a bit of a dead zone for him against Marlon Vera because Vera is so good at striking within the clinch. I haven't seen anything from Yanez that says, like, don't go to the clinch with him. So yeah, fuck it, do that. So those are the good fights covered. Let's do some questions and make up some time this week. Hey Jack, two questions for you today. Does your advice about working the body hold for an open stance situation? Although the round kick to the body opens up, the targets for the hands seem to shrink. Is the boxing heavy southpaw limited to more hand fighting than body shots? And a bit more goofy, you've talked before about the differences between ring and cage fighting for MMA, especially given the importance of wall walking, etc. If the field was a barrierless octagon-sized platform with a penalty for falling off, how would it affect the meta? Get-ups would be harder, but how else would grappling change? Given safety concerns, doing this in real life would obviously be a terrible idea. Please don't tell BKFC about it, but I'm curious about the hypothetical. Bullying Habib to a comeback match against Gleison Tibau Bless. From John. Right, let's do the serious one first. Body shots for the southpaw or against the southpaw. Open guard matchups. No, body punching is still very much viable. If you watch any high-level Muay Thai, a lot of guys can fight off both stances or kick off both stances well, but if you watch a fight where they're matched up open guard for a lot of it, or open stance. So southpaw versus orthodox. Yeah, you're all boys, you know what I mean. If you watch a fight like that in Muay Thai, you will see tons of the rear hand straight to the body. If you watch Sanchez's career, left straight to the body, constant. Trying to think of other southpaws. Fuck, I don't know any current Thais, but literally, go watch some Muay Thai with top fighters who are southpaws. It's all about the left straight to the body. Big money punch for them. And it plays into those combinations that they love, like left straight to the body, right uppercut. So lead hand uppercut, left high kick. Oh, Yodson Klein was great at those. Or left straight to the head, right hook or right uppercut to the body. Like into the, we talked about the kidney punch the other day, the Canelo Alvarez round the back one. You could do that with your lead hand. Prince Nazim was very good at that. On his rare occasions punching the body, he would do that. He'd duck down outside his opponent's lead shoulder as if he was loading up a big left hook to the head. They'd crunch up because they're terrified of him. Or the corkscrew right uppercut up the middle would be coming from that angle. So they'd crunch up and then he'd hit them in basically the love handle with his right hand. I think it's just that the lead hand hook to the body doesn't match up quite as nicely when you're not hitting either the liver or the solar plexus, which is what you're going to get with a good left hook from orthodox versus another orthodox fighter. And that's a killer, that punch that can take you out in one. So whereas the left straight to the body from southpaw tends to be more of a, like, you know, keep winding them, keep hitting them in the body, making them go oof, oof, you know, and setting up other punches, the left straight to right uppercut, the left straight to right hook, the left straight to left high kick. I mean, I like anything that comes off that same side as well. So you'll see left straight, left knee, left elbow, things like that. But for the body shot, left straight into left high kick is a great shout. I think there is certainly a case that you might be limited more to sort of one hand hitting the body because of the options opened up or closed off by the open guard situation. And often when you're in an open stance situation, both guys tend to stand more side on than square on. It's just how it tends to work out because they like to do their kicking with their back leg and reaching out to hand fight with the lead hand. I mean, you could stay tight and fight more square. There's a lot of boxers who've been square on southpaws, people like Michael Moore and shit like that. I mean, he won a world title, but he wasn't a great boxer. But there's lots of examples of more square on southpaws. But the left straight to the body has been a constant in Muay Thai. And a great example is of someone who transferred it over to a pure boxing context is Kaosai or Kaosai. Galaxy, K-H-A-O-S-A-I, Kaosai, yeah, but Kaosai Galaxy, he was a twin, I think, actually. He had a brother who also boxed, but he had incredible success. He was like, you know, one of the all-time greats in his weight class, certainly knockout-wise at least. And a lot of it he got done by hammering in the left straight to the body and then coming upstairs afterwards. I've seen people do effective body jabbing, southpaw versus orthodox. And when I say seen people, I mean, obviously, you do tons of people do it in boxing, but I've seen it done in MMA and in kickboxing as well. So it's not impossible. But yeah, if you stick to the... Well, I suppose it's if you're a southpaw, people are going to stick to the... Well, you know, people who aren't super comfortable against southpaws are going to stick to a more sort of like traditional versus southpaw 101 game. So they're going to be trying to shut down your lead hand, step outside your lead foot, throw the right straight down the center. Maybe trying to time a left hook over the top as you reach for them. But that sort of side-on hand-fighting stuff sort of makes the southpaw play into it and get involved in the hand-fighting stuff. If you stayed more compact and didn't hand-fight with them, maybe you'd open your right hand to the body up a bit more. But another thing that I think is important to remember when you're talking about like body hitting and making combinations, the left hook is nice because it can be... The left hook can be almost a left uppercut or like a really wide left hook. There's a lot of degrees there that you can do. And you're going inside the elbow, under the elbow, behind the elbow. You know, you see Gennady Golovkin throw lots of punches with his palm down, with his elbow very wide to get behind the opponent's elbow. There's a lot of nuance. And especially because it comes from the infight a lot of the time, which is a lot harder to get to when your lead legs are sort of in the way of each other as well. But I think another important point to remember when you're talking about like combination punching and body hitting, and particularly from a kickboxing context or whatever, is that there are multiple levels to the body. It's not all like one band around their waist that you're aiming for. You can punch, you can jab to their head, throw a right straight to the sternum, you know, which isn't like a vital point. And I mean, vital point is a term that sounds very like dim muck, but I just mean like the traditional things you aim for. Like it's hard because you have to discredit like the chi stuff and the no, oh, I used this pressure point and he just lets go of me stuff. But you do have to appreciate that aiming is important, because if you hit the jaw, the temples, the eyes, they're all good. If you hit the solar plexus, that's a money shot. If you hit the liver, the floating ribs, those are money shots. If you hit the sternum, less so. It'll have the effect of taking the air out of them a bit, but it's not like if you catch them dead to rights on the solar plexus, that really fucking hurts. But if you hit them in the sternum, you'll get a little bit of wind out of them. And then you can continue down the body with the right hook underneath or on the right side. The spleen, as Bas Rutten would say, or the kidney if they're turning quite side on. But, you know, that's three levels rather than two. You're not going jab, body shot. You're going jab to the head, left straight to the chest, right hook to the lower abdomen. And then low kick if you fancy to finish it off. But it's... Yeah, it's very easy to get caught up in the idea that there's just like two targets on the body and one hand's aiming for one and one hand's aiming for the other. If you watch really good body punches, doesn't matter which stance they're from, doesn't matter what sport they're in, there's a lot of variation in targets. Even like just 2 inches left or right on your shot, you know, makes a big difference, or up or down. And that's why doubling up is also so important, because you see guys go, they'll throw their first one to whack the elbow to like reinforce where it needs to be, and then... The second one will come up in an uppercut or come inside in an uppercut to the body. But yeah, southpaw body hitting, very possible beyond the left straight. The left straight is something that every southpaw should be working on constantly, the left straight to the body, because you've got the left straight up top as the scary thing anyway. And they're going to try and take it away. And a couple of the ways that they try and take it away will leave the body open. So you might as well throw it. But a lot of the stuff with the southpaw matchup is just sort of like hampering the infight. Because of the way the legs are configured, you know, they get in the way of each other. Or if you get outside the opponents, they're going to worry and run away. You know, if you get inside the opponents and you hit them good, they're going to move out, they're going to pivot out around it. So it doesn't like it doesn't lend itself to the infight quite as well as if you've both got your left foot forward and you just march in at each other and put your lead shoulder on each other's chests. But play with it, because like you don't ever let anyone tell you something is impossible from a stance or whatever. It's more that you have to find a way to do it. And then what was the wacky question? Oh, no barrier platform. That already exists. Now, see, we were talking about the Lai Tai, which is ancient Chinese form of combat. Like, you know, when you test your wushu against someone else's. Is it Lai Tai or Lei Tai? Hold on. I'm going to have to look it up now. Oh, no, it's the Lei Tai. L-E-I-T-A-I in romanticized speak. But according to Wikipedia, the Lai Tai is an elevated platform arena without railings where often fatal weapons and bare-knuckle martial arts tournaments were once held. Yep, don't know much about the history of it, as in, like, how legit it is, but there are, like, modern forms of that competition. And then there was the Ganryu Jima. I was like, is Ganryu the right person, the right one? Ganryu is my main on Tekken. Ganryu Jima is the moat fighting, and they're quite an interesting little company. I think they're Japanese, but they're still very interested in doing like the style versus style stuff. So they hired Kakuno to be the karate representative. They got a capoeira guy. They got a what's the Florentine football game? Calico something or other. Captain Calico, Calico Jack. Oh no, Calcio. Fuck, can't remember the name, but the bare knuckle football game that they hold in Florence every year between the four quarters of the city, which if you didn't know about, you do now. Go check it out. It's pretty cool. It's a medieval sport that they've kept going. But yeah, they're doing their sort of style versus style stuff. And yeah, pushing people off the platform works a lot too. I've not watched that much of it, but the ones that I have watched have been like largely striking affairs. Because obviously if you enter a clinch, that's wrestling, and then you go off the side of the cage. That's your main goal, go off the side of the arena or get them off the side of the arena. So it doesn't really go to the ground a lot from what I've seen. If you were on the ground, it's interesting because even if you have that context, like that rule of a ring out being legal, are suicide ring outs allowed? You know, sacrifice throws and things. Well, not just sacrifice throws, but like, am I allowed, if I take you down into close guard, am I allowed to just crawl us off the edge? And as long as you're on the bottom when we fall off, or you go off first, is that me winning? Because if you say that, like, it's not a win if both guys go off at the same time, or if you throw someone off and you're off as a result, then you make things very interesting. Because the guy who's being thrown out, like, if you catch someone's leg off a kick and you drive them towards the edge of the arena, you know, plow the fields or whatever they call it in Thailand, the other guy, like, will do what he would do in a life and death fight, which is grab a hold of you and try and take you with him. And then you add another consideration that doesn't exist in any other combat sport. God, that's a fascinating thought. They should do that with Ganryu Jima if they bring it back. Just do one with the rule where it's all ring outs and the first person out loses. Like in sumo, both of you fall on your hands or both of you fall out of the ring. It's the one who touched the ground first. So guys will like throw their arms up behind them and make sure like they'll be falling forwards and they'll throw their arms out behind them so they don't catch themselves and they fall on their teeth. Just so they get a split second later than the opponent touching down. You know, it's a way of, that's where the sport encourages you to injure yourself almost in some occasions, but, or the rules of the sport rather. But if you did the Ganryu that way with the sumo sort of rules, and then you did Ganryu Jima with the no sacrifice of yourself rules, as in like, if you both go out, both lose, that'd be fascinating. But I seem to recall Kakuno mopped up in those, because even though he went off the deep end, he's into like really stupid ways of fighting now. Like there was a time when he was genuinely very scary, when Eddie Alvarez fought him and he was very tricky. But then he fought Daisuke Nakamura, I think it is, which is a fight I can no longer find online. If you have it, send it to me, because it's the watershed on when Kakuno just goes full retard. He fights with his hands down by his thighs. For no, like he used to have his hands up open in front of him, which looked like a zombie, but he was parrying punches. But then he just dropped his hands completely, and that's what he brought to the UFC for God knows what reason. And he's just looked awful since. But he did well in that Ganryu Jima. He just murdered people. Tom says, "Dear Jack, insert something witty here. A random question for you. After watching an Ernesto Hoost highlight, I remembered he'd lost to Bob Sapp twice. What I hadn't realized was that both fights were part of the 2002 K1 Grand Prix, which Hoost would go on to win. Brackets, lots of question marks and exclamation marks. My two questions are, one, do you think Sapp could have gone all the way, beating Ray Seifo and Jerome Labana? Brackets, bearing in mind, Sapp was technically unbeaten in K1 at the time, his only loss coming from a DQ. And two, can you think of another fighter who had a random boogeyman? Someone who you would assume would be below their ability, but they couldn't beat in their fight record. The only one, other one I can think of is Dennis Hallman with Matt Hughes. Much love and respect from a proud Patreon boy, Tom. P.S. Promise I'll think of a more current question next time. No, we like the old school stuff. Right, I've just taken a minute to refresh my memory of the situation. And Sapp met in the opening round, so the qualifiers for the K1 Grand Prix in 2002, which I believe is 8 matches, 16 men, which brings you down to 8 for the quarterfinals, which is when you do all the fights back to back. So Sapp beats Hoost in October to qualify. But Schilt is injured and can't continue despite qualifying. The entire setup was bizarre. I've just pulled up the tournament table. In the first round, you had like Jerome Labana got to fight Gary Goodridge and knock him out. Whereas like Peter Ayers had to get past Glaub Feitosa. Actually, Ray Seifo got Martin Holm, which isn't a particularly hard fight. Anyway, first round, Sammy Schilt fights Michael McDonald, wins the decision, then is injured and can't continue to the quarterfinals. So they invite Hoost, who's just lost to Bob Sapp, back to fight in his place. But the way that the table was working out, it meant that he just had to fight Bob Sapp again. The even weirder part is that like they had 7 matchups, and then Musashi, all these other guys, they qualified by winning their first fight at final elimination. Musashi qualified by winning the K1 Andy Spirits Japan Grand Prix. So they had this place set aside for like local Japanese lad, who then got smoked by Jerome Labana after he got his bye. But yeah, Bob Sapp beat Ernesto Hoost again. But Bob Sapp was injured in the process, so Ernesto Hoost stepped in again, fought Ray Seifo, knocked him out in the semifinal, and then fought Jerome Labana and knocked him out in the final. Truly bizarre. I forgot it was all in one tournament, both the Bob Sapp losses, and that Ernesto Hoost won the tournament despite losing both fights, which is so funny because Combate America, who I never watch, but they've just announced they're going to do a one-night MMA tournament in the US, or it might be Mexico, actually, but they're going to do a one-night MMA tournament. And I was like, yes, I love one-night MMA tournaments, but I do love them for how wacky they are. At the end of the... It really isn't like who's the best fighter in the world on the night. It's a lot to do with luck, because you can get hurt worse winning than losing sometimes. It's just one of the weird ways that fighting works. If you cripple your ankle knocking someone out with a high kick, you know, pretty extreme example, but they might be in better shape to fight again immediately after than you, especially in Japan where they don't care if you got knocked out. But yes, I remember Sean Baby writing about that fight back in the day where he said Ernesto Hoost got to work showing the prettiest way to execute a Yeti and then somehow lost anyway. But Sapp was scary back then, man. Because before it became apparent he couldn't take a punch and his will sort of broke, and then he went into like just being a flop artist. But you know, before he'd been made to question himself, he had all the physical attributes on these guys. You know, you can't like technique will make up for a lack of physicality in a matchup, but it can only go so far. Like if I roll with a 300-pound athletic dude, I'm gonna have a horrible time, even if he's done like 3 weeks of jiu-jitsu. And probably worse if he's like done 3 weeks of Muay Thai and he's 300 pounds and 6'5" and I'm having to spar him. And we're talking 300 pounds jacked here, because that's what Bob Sapp was. So looking at Bob's record, the big kickoff is 2002. He's sort of kickboxing and doing MMA simultaneously. So while he only had the one loss in kickboxing, he'd only had like 2 fights by the time he met Ernesto Hoost. He fought Cyril Abidi, who, you know, in fairness, I do always say Cyril Abidi I only know for really getting knocked out, but he was a decent kickboxer. He was just very small and fighting in like the K1 open weight, you know, heavyweight Grand Prix stuff. So yeah, it doesn't surprise me that Bob overwhelmed him. But in MMA by this time, he'd already met Antonio Rodrigo Nogueira, and lost in August of 2002. This K1 Grand Prix was October and December was like the big one-night tournament. And almost immediately after this, like his next fight after the second Hoost fight, he comes back in March of 2003. Mirko Krokop knocks him out with the left straight to the head, and he crunches up in a ball. And then he fights like Kimo Leopoldo, and then it just goes downhill from there. And obviously Ray Seifo does beat the shit out of him soon afterwards. I think there probably still was some of the aura about Sapp that maybe could have carried him to a win. Because this is the thing, like, you know, I can't see him mauling and brawling with Jerome Labana in the final. Because Jerome Labana was a brick shithouse in his own right. You know, Bob was probably still have like 30, 40 pounds on him. But, you know, having stood next to Jerome Labana at events, he's a monstrous man, even at this old age. But he did always have the sus chin. Don't know how much that would affect in this fight, because like Bob Sapp had sort of like that Jess Willard, Primo Carnera thing, where it's like, yeah, anytime a man that size hits or moves his hand into your head, it's going to have a bit more force than if someone who was your size is just sort of throwing it out there. But he doesn't have like pop on his punches. What he tends to do is sort of like just grind people out, and then something will hit them and hurt them. Just like a sloppy connection, because he's just a massive man. So I could see that happening late with Labana. You know, Ernesto Hoost was in great shape, and he still got tired out dealing with Sapp. And Seifo, maybe if he was affected by the aura of Sapp. But I think that's the thing. Like the Krokop one, the moment after that, you can. Well, I mean, the Ray Seifo one, like Sapp is curling up into a ball. He's falling over. He's trying still. But he's still like getting hit and going, oh, no, I don't like it. Whereas the Ernesto Hoost ones, like he's getting chopped up his legs and stuff. He's getting hit, but he's very much going through it. I think something did break in him with the Krokop loss. Because like if you watch the Rodrigo Nogueira fight, like I can imagine he would still have a good deal of his aura after that. Because yeah, Nogueira beat him, but he took a horrible beating. And he won on technique and didn't really hurt Bob Sapp at all. He won on gas tank and having technical superiority on the ground. You know, technical superiority isn't going to win you a fight outright like that on the feet, probably. You know, I mean, Ernesto Hoost had technical superiority and he was doing it for minutes at a time and still got beat. So maybe Bob Sapp could have gone all the way. I just don't know, because like I think that Krokop fight really is a breaking point in Sapp's career, where he starts questioning himself. I think he did a lot better when he was just bravely going out after it and trying to run over people. You know, it was ugly, didn't really work especially well, but I did beat him, you know, did allow him to beat Ernesto Hoost twice. So I don't know. But in terms of boogeymen, Dennis Hallman would be my number one, because he beat Matt Hughes back in the days before Matt Hughes was UFC welterweight champion. They brought him in to lose to Matt Hughes once Matt Hughes was like at the top of his game, and he still somehow beat Matt Hughes. It was very weird. They tried to do the same with John Lober they brought in for Frank Shamrock, because Frank had gone to the draw with him way back in the day, and Lober never really got any better, and Frank was like the best in the world at the time. So that's not an example of what you're talking about. This is the thing, like there's a lot of people who just think that Kevin Lee's not very good anyway, but I always felt like Kevin Lee was a better fighter than Ally Aquinta, but Ally Aquinta had his number. Like, Ally Aquinta struggles with tons of dudes who just aren't particularly special, like Bobby Green. Whereas Kevin Lee could really like impress you smashing dudes until he hit like the top end of the division. But Ally Aquinta was always the odd one out there that Ally Aquinta could give him so much trouble. Another one might be like Hisaki Kato. We talked about earlier this week. I was talking about Joe Schilling's career being sort of retconned to actually have always been crap. But no, like Hisaki Kato did that to him. Hisaki Kato, good kudo. Is he a kudo fighter? He does one of those weird forms of karate. But definitely not like Artem Levin or Simon Marcus. Yet he beat Schilling in the MMA cage and they were like, well, we'll redo it in kickboxing. And then he beat him in kickboxing too. And I think a lot of that is to do with where Joe Schilling was at and Joe Schilling's chin. But Yeah, it must be weird to be able to have beaten Artem Levin and Simon Marcus and people like that, and then not be able to beat Hisaki Kato as he sort of spazzes out awkwardly. Well, let me know in the comments if you think of any others, because they're out there and I just can't think of them. Boxing has must have loads of instances of like a spoiler who just has one guy's number. But anyway, I reckon that'll do us for today. Bit of a slow week in terms of fights. I hope they live up to I hope they succeed expectations, because the expectations ain't that high. And then next week, I think, what do we get next week? Hold on. Then we got a little bit of a dry spell for a week. And then we've got both Kyoji Horiguchi versus Sergio Pettis, a Bellator, which looks quite decent. No, I'm lying. It doesn't look that decent, but that fight is good. And then we've got Font versus Aldo the same weekend. So that'll be a banger, hopefully. As well as Fiziev versus Riddle, Matt Brown versus Barbarena, Jimmy Crute versus Jamal. That's a good, that's a pretty decent card. Nice. It's worth the week off. So I will be back on Monday and we'll talk about all the stuff that happened at the weekend. In the meantime, I'm going to get to work writing some stuff. I will catch you. You know where to see all my shit. I will catch you on Monday. Ernesto Hoost's muffin top flopping around as he low kicks Bob Sapp. Bless.